I woke at 6 the next morning and found George awake too. We both turned round and tried to go to sleep again, but we couldn't. Had there been any particular reason why we should not have gone to sleep again, but have got up and dressed then and there, we should have dropped off while we were looking at our watches and have slept till 10. As there was no earthly necessity for our getting up under another 2 hours at the very least, and our getting up at that time was an utter absurdity, it was only in keeping with the natural cussedness of things in general that we should both feel that lying down for 5 minutes more would be the death of us. I set to work to wake up Harris with the skull. The third prod did it, and he turned over on the other side and said he would be down in a minute, and that he would have his lace-up boots. We soon let him know where he was, however, by the aid of the hitcher, and he sat up suddenly, sending Montmorency, who'd been sleeping the sleep of the just, right on the middle of his chest, sprawling across the boat. Then we pulled up the canvas, and all four of us poked our head out over the offside, and looked down at the water, and shivered. The idea, overnight, had been that we should get up early in the morning, fling off our rugs and shawls, and throwing back the canvas, spring into the river with a joyous shout, and revel in a long, delicious swim. Somehow, now the morning had come, the notion seemed less tempting. The water looked damp and chilly. The wind felt cold. "Well, who's going to be first in?" said Harris at last. There was no rush for precedence. George settled the matter, so far as he was concerned, by retiring into the boat and pulling on his socks. Montmorency gave vent to an involuntary howl, as if merely thinking of the thing had given him the horrors. And Harris said it would be so difficult to get into the boat again, and went back and sorted out his trousers. I did not altogether like to give in, though I didn't relish the plunge. There might be snags about, or weeds, I thought. I meant to compromise matters by going down to the edge and just throwing the water over myself. So I took a towel and crept out onto the bank and wormed my way along onto the branch of a tree that dipped down into the water. It was bitterly cold. The wind cut like a knife. I thought perhaps I would not throw the water over myself after all. I would go back into the boat and dress. And I turned to do so, and as I turned, the silly branch gave way, and I and the towel went in together with a tremendous splash, and I was out midstream with a gallon of Thames water inside me before I knew what had happened. "By Jove, old Jay's gone in!" I heard Harris say as I came blowing to the surface. "I didn't think he'd have the pluck to do it, did you?" "Is it all right?" sang out George. "Aha! Lovely!" I spluttered back. "You are duffers not to come in. I wouldn't have missed this for the world. Why don't you try it? It only wants a little determination." But I could not persuade them. Rather an amusing thing happened while dressing that morning. I was very cold when I got back into the boat, and in my hurry to get my shirt on, I accidentally jerked it into the water. It made me awfully wild, especially as George burst out laughing. I could not see anything to laugh at, and I told George so, and he only laughed the more. I never saw a man laugh so much. I quite lost my temper with him at last, and I pointed out to him what a drivelling maniac of an imbecile idiot he was, but he only roared the louder. And then, just as I was landing the shirt, I noticed that it was not my shirt at all, but George's, which I had mistaken for mine. Whereupon, the humour of the thing struck me for the first time, and I began to laugh. And the more I looked from George's wet shirt to George, roaring with laughter, the more I was amused, and I laughed so much that I had to let the shirt fall back into the water again.
"Oh, aren't you... aren't you going to get it out?"
said George between his shrieks. I couldn't answer him at all for a while, I was laughing so, but at last, between my peals, I managed to jerk out, "It isn't my shirt, it's yours!" I never saw a man's face change from lively to severe so suddenly in all my life before.
"What?"
he yelled, springing up.
"You silly cuckoo! Why can't you be more careful what you're doing? Why the deuce don't you go and dress on the bank? You're not fit to be in a boat, you're not! Give me the hitcher!"
I tried to make him see the fun of the thing, but he couldn't. George is very dense at seeing a joke sometimes. Harris proposed that we should have scrambled eggs for breakfast. He said he would cook them. It seemed, from his account, that he was very good at doing scrambled eggs. He often did them at picnics and went out on yachts. He was quite famous for them. People who had once tasted his scrambled eggs, so we gathered from his conversation, never cared for any other food afterwards, but pined away and died when they couldn't get them. It made our mouths water to hear him talk about the things, and we handed him out the stove and the frying pan and all the eggs that had not smashed and gone over everything in the hamper, and begged him to begin. He had some trouble in breaking the eggs, or rather not so much trouble in breaking them exactly, as in getting them into the frying pan when broken, and keeping them off his trousers, and preventing them from running up his sleeve. But he fixed some half a dozen into the pan at last, and then squatted down by the side of the stove and chivied them about with a fork. It seemed harassing work, so far as George and I could judge. Whenever he went near the pan, he burned himself, and then he would drop everything and dance round the stove, flicking his fingers about and cursing the things. Montmorency went and put his nose over it once, and the fat spluttered up and scalded him, and then he began dancing and cursing. The result was not altogether the success that Harris had anticipated. There seemed so little to show for the business. Six eggs had gone into the frying pan, and all that came out was a teaspoonful of burnt and unappetizing-looking mess. Harris said it was the fault of the frying pan, and thought it would have gone better if we'd had a fish kettle and a gas stove, and we decided not to attempt the dish again until we had those aids to housekeeping by us. The sun had got more powerful by the time we'd finished breakfast, and the wind had dropped, and it was as lovely a morning as one could desire. After you pass Old Windsor, the river is somewhat uninteresting, and does not become itself again until you're reaching Boveney. George and I towed up past the Home Park, which stretches along the right bank from Albert to Victoria Bridge. We tugged steadily on to a little below Monkey Island, where we drew up and lunched. We tackled the cold beef for lunch, and then we found that we'd forgotten to bring any mustard. I don't think I ever, in my life, before or since, felt I wanted mustard as badly as I felt I wanted it then. I don't care for mustard as a rule, and it's very seldom that I take it at all, but I would have given worlds for it then. It cast a gloom over the boat, there being no mustard. We ate our beef in silence. Existence seemed hollow and uninteresting. We thought of the happy days of childhood and sighed. We brightened up a bit, however, over the apple tart, and when George drew out a tin of pineapple from the bottom of the hamper and rolled it into the middle of the boat, we felt that life was worth living after all. We are very fond of pineapple, all three of us. We looked at the picture on the tin, we thought of the juice, we smiled at one another, and Harris got a spoon ready. Then we looked for the knife to open the tin with. We turned out everything in the hamper. We turned out the bags. We pulled up the boards at the bottom of the boat. We took everything out onto the bank and shook it. There was no tin opener to be found. Then Harris tried to open the tin with a pocket knife, and broke the knife and cut himself badly. And George tried a pair of scissors, and the scissors flew up and nearly put his eye out. While they were dressing their wounds, I tried to make a hole in the thing with the spiky end of the hitcher, and the hitcher slipped and jerked me out between the boat and the bank into 2 feet of muddy water, and the tin rolled over, uninjured, and broke a teacup. Then we all got mad. We took that tin out onto the bank, and Harris went up into a field and got a big sharp stone, and I went back into the boat and brought out the mast, and George held the tin, and Harris held the sharp end of his stone against the top of it, and I took the mast and poised it high up in the air and gathered up all my strength and brought it down. It was George's straw hat that saved his life that day. He keeps that hat now, what's left of it, and of a winter's evening, when the pipes are lit and the boys are telling stretchers about the dangers they have passed through, George brings it down and shows it round, and the stirring tale is told anew, with fresh exaggerations every time. Harris got off with merely a flesh wound. After that, I took the tin off myself, and hammered at it with the mast until I was worn out and sick at heart, whereupon Harris took it in hand. We beat it out flat. We beat it back square. We battered it into every form known to geometry, but we could not make a hole in it. Then George went at it, and knocked it into a shape so strange, so weird, so unearthly in its wild hideousness, that he got frightened and threw away the mast. Then we all three sat round it on the grass and looked at it. There was one great dent across the top that had the appearance of a mocking grin, and it drove us furious, so that Harris rushed at the thing and caught it up and flung it far into the middle of the river. And as it sank, we hurled our curses at it, and we got into the boat and rowed away from the spot and never paused until we reached Maidenhead. Maidenhead itself is too snobby to be pleasant. It is a town of showy hotels, patronised chiefly by dukes and ballet girls. It is the witch's kitchen from which go forth those demons of the river, steam launches. The London Journal Duke always has his little place at Maidenhead, and the heroine of the three-volume novel always dines there when she goes out on a spree with somebody else's husband. We went through Maidenhead quickly, and then eased up and took leisurely that grand reach beyond Bolters and Cookham Locks. Clifden Woods still wore their dainty dress of spring and rose up from the water's edge in one long harmony of blended shades of fairy green. In its unbroken loveliness, this is, perhaps, the sweetest stretch of all the river, and lingeringly we slowly drew our little boat away from its deep peace. We pulled up in the backwater just below Cookham and had tea, and, when we were through the lock, it was evening. A stiffish breeze had sprung up, in our favour, for a wonder, for, as a rule on the river, the wind is always dead against you whatever way you go. It is against you in the morning, when you start for a day's trip, and you pull a long distance thinking how easy it will be to come back with the sail. Then, after the tea, the wind veers round, and you have to pull hard in its teeth all the way home. When you forget to take the sail at all, then the wind is consistently in your favour both ways. But there, this world is only a probation, and man was born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. This evening, however, they'd evidently made a mistake, and had put the wind round at our back, instead of in our face. We kept very quiet about it, and got the sail up quickly before they found it out, and then we spread ourselves about the boat in thoughtful attitudes, and the sail bellied out, and strained, and grumbled at the mast, and the boat flew. I steered. There is no more thrilling sensation I know of than sailing. It comes as near to flying as man has got to yet, except in dreams. The wings of the rushing wind seem to be bearing you onward, you know not where. You are no longer the slow, plodding, puny thing of clay, creeping tortuously upon the ground. You are a part of nature. Your heart is throbbing against hers, her glorious arms around you, raising you up against her heart. Your spirit is at one with hers. Your limbs grow light. The voices of the air are singing to you. The earth seems far away and little, and the clouds, so close above your head, are brothers, and you stretch your arms to them. We had the river to ourselves, except that, far in the distance, we could see a fishing punt, moored in midstream, on which three fishermen sat, and we skimmed over the water and past the wooded banks, and no one spoke. I was steering. As we drew nearer, we could see that the three men fishing seemed old and solemn-looking men. They sat on three chairs in the punt and watched intently their lines, and the red sunset threw a mystic light upon the waters, and tinged with fire the towering woods, and made a golden glory of the piled-up clouds. It was an hour of deep enchantment, of ecstatic hope and longing. The little sail stood out against the purple sky. The gloaming lay around us, wrapping the world in rainbow shadows. And behind us crept the night. We seemed like knights of some old legend, sailing across some mystic lake into the unknown realm of twilight, unto the great land of the sunset. We did not go into the realm of twilight. We went slap into that punt, where those three old men were fishing. We did not know what had happened at first, because the sail shut out the view, but from the nature of the language that rose up upon the evening air, we gathered that we'd come into the neighbourhood of human beings, and that they were vexed and discontented. Harris let the sail down, and then we saw what had happened. We had knocked those three old gentlemen off their chairs into a general heap at the bottom of the boat, and they were now, slowly and painfully, sorting themselves out from each other and picking fish off themselves. And as they worked, they cursed us, not with a common cursory curse, but with long, carefully thought-out, comprehensive curses that embraced the whole of our career and went away into the distant future and included all our relations and covered everything connected with us. Good, substantial curses. Harris told them they ought to be grateful for a little excitement, sitting there fishing all day, and he also said that he was shocked and grieved to hear men their age give way to temper so. But it didn't do any good. George said he would steer after that. He said a mind like mine ought not to be expected to give itself away in steering boats. Better let a mere commonplace human being see after that boat before we jolly well all got drowned. And he took the lines and brought us up to Marlow. And at Marlow, we left the boat by the bridge and went and put up for the night at the Crown.